supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. My guest today, Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen, author, doctor, lecturer, teacher, and a patient with Crohn's disease. I found a poem she wrote about her experience as a patient and thought it would be a great way to introduce her for today's show. It begins, "O body, for 40 years, 1,327 experts with a combined 16,787 years of training have failed to cure your deep wounds. Deep inside, I am whole." Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen has dedicated her career to finding pathways for healing. She's a pioneer in the field of holistic medicine and the best-selling author of Kitchen Table Wisdom and My Grandfather's Blessings. Rachel, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you, Dan. Good morning.
Good morning. It's good to hear your voice. How are you feeling?
I'm pretty good this morning, and you?
Good. Yeah, the same. I'm pretty good this morning also. To our listeners, our number is 1-888-477-9499 if you want to call in and speak with Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen. If you are a doctor, please call, or if you are a patient and want to address the issue of curing versus healing, that's 888-477-9499. Rachel, in today's healthcare world, doctors are trained to cure. And even psychotherapists, the newer psychotherapies, are being trained at, not cure, but certainly symptom elimination. So What do you see as the difference between curing and healing, and is there a place for both?
Well, there needs to be a place for both in today's world. You know, first of all, curing is something that's a question of expertise. It takes years to learn how to cure people. And it happens on the level of the body. We restore the function and integrity of the body, and whatever was the problem becomes a part of the past. But not everything can be cured. Science has become so powerful that people are living today, many, many, many people, with things that they would have died of in the past. And these people need to find a way to live as whole people, even though they face physical challenges, you know, in a daily way. Healing is about that process. It's about the process of living as a whole person, no matter what your body is able to do. And healing is always possible, even in the absence of cure. Always a possibility. It's always possible to lead a good life, even though it isn't an easy life, Dan.
I attended, I was asked to lecture years ago, a group of urologists. And I was sitting in the back of the room. The lecturer before me was speaking and taking questions. And one of the doctors in the audience raised his hand, raising a question about one of his patients with spinal cord injury. He didn't know I was in the room. And he raised his hand and he said, "Can you advise me how I would tell a patient with a spinal cord injury that he's now a half a man?" He didn't know I was sitting behind him. And
how would you have answered him? My God.
I said, I don't consider myself a half a man, and in many respects, I am more whole than I ever was before because of my spinal cord injury. I am more comfortable becoming the man I am rather than the man I always thought I should be.
Mm-hmm.
However, that's my memory filters that are giving you that answer. I don't think I was that kind to him. I'm not that good a person, you know. I think I embarrassed him, and I also think I enjoyed it a little bit. But that does bring us to the topic of doctors and how they're trained and what happens to them. I want to read something you said in a previous interview, and then have you comment on it. You said, physicians have been wounded by their training. We are taught, we physicians are taught, that objectivity is an invulnerable stance, but objectivity actually makes us vulnerable. You go on to say in your interview that when we are objective, we cannot cry or grieve or even pray, and you don't even know that you're loved by the people you are serving. It's a pretty powerful statement, and it does raise some questions. Traditional doctors would argue with you that crying and grieving and praying, these powerful emotions could contribute to burnout. And what doctors need, what patients need, is somebody who's strong and confident and competent.
Well, actually, not crying and not being close to people, not knowing their stories, not celebrating their triumphs, not participating in the lives in front of you is what does cause burnout, Dan. You know, most of the young people who come into medicine today are quite wonderful. I teach a course called The Healer's Art. I've taught it for 15 years at UCSF, and it's a course which enables young doctors to explore the deep meaning of their work, its deep satisfactions, and to become the kind of doctors their patients need them to be. This course is now taught in 53 other medical schools across the United States and even in places like Slovenia and Israel. These young people are on fire with the spirit of service. And in 4 years, they become cynical, depressed, alienated, angry, hostile. And it's a process. The training is brutal. The training is very difficult. And what it does is it makes doctors unable to serve people.
Why is the training brutal? It always felt to me that a part of it is almost like ritualized hazing in its brutality. And part of it is the sheer volume of knowledge these poor kids must acquire.
Well, that's a piece of it, but there's also a kind of a macho quality to it. This is changing now because, you know, a little more than half of all the medical students in the United States are now young women. Hmm. And this has been the case for maybe the last 7 or 8 years. So there are more and more people for whom a macho position is not, you know, their only fallback, shall we say. But there is enormous pressure on these young people to be perfect. I mean, so much is at stake. Well, and they always feel not good enough.
And, you know, most of these young people who go to medical school, the pressure on them to be perfect has probably been there most of their lives.
Yes, that's true. That's absolutely true. And they don't cut themselves much slack. They don't allow themselves their own humanity. They don't recognize that their humanity may be exactly what enables their patient to find the strength to struggle against an obstacle and to live.
I had an experience several years ago. I was in the hospital and I was quite ill. And it was a Sunday. I was getting raging blood pressures and terrible headaches. And we called, it was a Sunday, so the resident was there, the neurosurgical resident. And he didn't come up. We must have called him 5, 6, 7 times and we didn't come up. And finally he came up. And he was angry and resentful, and he said, look, I think your best bet is just to sign yourself out and go home and get an outpatient doctor to take care of you. And I was deathly ill, and I was angry and upset, and he left. And when I got out of the hospital, I wrote a very angry letter to his supervisors, to the chief resident, chief of neurology. And he wrote me back, and he apologized. And he said he was having a terrible day that day, and he also had a headache. He felt out of control. There was too many problems, many he felt he did not have the skills to handle. And I said to him, if you had come into my room and pulled up a chair and sat down and told me about your day, maybe both of our headaches would have diminished a bit. But he was a neurosurgical resident. He didn't respond to my letter because that's not the way they're trained.
Well, the training changes us. But fortunately, we're able to change back.
It's been
about that, helping doctors to remember why they've come into this, not just what they know, but why they've come, and that this work is so much more than it's science. It's a way of life.
We're talking with Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen, well-known physician, healer, author, doctor, lecturer, world renowned. Our number is 888-477-9499. I want to come back to that quote. And you said that when physicians are being objective, they cannot know that they're loved by the person they're serving.
Mm-hmm.
Do patients love their doctors?
I certainly love my doctors. The people who have been with me, we have been a we. In the face of some very difficult times and dark places, people who have accompanied me and have given me everything that they had to give, I not only love them, but I'm just grateful to them.
Well, gratitude I can relate to, and doctors I've had over the years, I can feel great affection for. I don't know about love. But the standard doctors where you see them for 14 minutes and then you have to move on, or they have to move on, you can't love someone like that. You can't know someone like that, and vice versa.
Well, let me say something about two things about that. First of all, doctors love their patients. They may not be able to express it that directly, but their patients matter. Nobody would live this very difficult life of being a physician if people didn't matter to you, sometimes very passionately. You've given up a great deal of your youth, a great deal of your time, in order to be able to do this work. And, you know, you see this so clearly, that, especially with the students. Their patients matter greatly to them. They see medicine as an expression of love. They see it as an expression of service, which is a special kind of love, befriending the life in another person. And there's an intimacy in it. Often, you know, you may know a person far better than their family does in some ways, far better than their neighbors do, because we're in such dark and intimate places with people, and places where people have nothing to hide. And so there is this dimension of medicine, and it's what drives the whole thing.
I want to talk more about your course, The Healer's Art.
Yeah.
You know, your description of it says you help medical students to become the kind of doctors their patients want them to be.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of doctors do we need? People like you and me and everybody else who carries the label patient.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you and I carry a special kind of label patient. We carry the label chronic illness. And that is different than having a time-limited problem, like going and having your gallbladder out and it's removed and, you know, you go back about your life. For us, the medical system is a part of our lives. And it can be a part of our lives that diminishes us, or it can be a part of our lives that enables us to fulfill our dream of ourselves. And so, you know, this is the needs of people who are chronically ill, this very, very large group of people, which did not exist when I went to medical school. People died of Crohn's disease. They died after injuries like your own accident. But you and I have not died. We've lived for years and years and years under altered circumstances. And we need something different from our doctors.
One of the benefits I'm getting from my doctors is when I talk to them about what I have and what can be done going forward, they're able to say, and I call this a benefit, it's going to sound odd, they're able to say, we don't know. You're the first generation that's lived this long with quadriplegia. Right. There's no data. And in a way, that position is frightening. But in a way, I feel like I'm very much partnered with my doctor.
Yes.
And we're going to figure it out together, and we're going to honor one another's knowledge and experience going forward.
Exactly. And there's a great freedom in it. You know, many times people have come into my life knowing what was going to happen for me, and thereby putting me into a box that was too small. All because, you know, when I first became ill, I was told I would be dead by the time I was 40.
Mm-hmm.
I'd had multiple surgeries. No one knew how to cure this disease. No one even knew what caused it. And I would be dead by the time I was 40. I was 15 years old. My whole future was taken away. I'm 69 now. I have not been dead for 29 years. But I lived my life for quite a long time as if I would be dead by the time I was 40. I never married. I never had children. I made many life decisions that were not good decisions because I was put in too small a box.
Mm. Do you feel resentment towards those doctors?
Not really. I think they were giving me the best that they knew. But I think we all need to wonder more and to know a little less. That any time anyone confronts a diagnosis, there's a question of mystery. There's the will to live in people, something that can't be measured by science, but something that plays out in people's lives in a daily way.
Well, Rachel, we've got to take a short break, and when we come back, we've got lots of people who want to join the conversation. But I want to talk about that phrase you just used, the will to live. I just wrote an article in today's Inquirer about Elizabeth Edwards and Tony Snow,
yes,
and their decisions that seem different, but right under the surface, they're identical. They're both just about that, the will to live. So we'll talk about that, and we'll go to our callers also. We're going to take a 60-second break. We're talking with Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen, author, doctor, lecturer, teacher, healer, patient. She's written Kitchen Table Wisdom and My Grandfather's Blessings, both bestsellers, and both are wonderful books. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. If you've had experience as a patient and want to address issues of healing and what is and was healing for you, if you're a doctor and want to give us a call and talk about what medicine means to you, what healing, what caring means to you, 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Penn supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit are providing evaluations to determine if you are suffering from depression. Symptoms may include mood swings, irritability, sleep disturbance, and lack of interest. Those who qualify may receive an initial examination and treatment with an investigational antidepressant for 3 to 12 months. For information, the DRU number at Penn is 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
On the next Fresh Air, the Axis of Evil comedy tour makes a stop on our show. Comics and actors Maz Jobrani, Ahmed Ahmed, and Aaron Kader are respectively of Iranian, Egyptian, and Palestinian descent. Their special premiered on Comedy Central last month and is now out on DVD. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. We're with Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen, one of the stalwarts in holistic medicine, and written best-selling Kitchen Table Wisdom, My Grandfather's Blessing. She is a doctor, a patient, a healer, a teacher. I guess all healers and doctors are teachers. So you talked about the will to live. And I think that's inherent in almost everyone. You know, I in my column today, I said to my readers, I said, what would you do? What would you do if you just found out that your life was measured in statistics and probability that 5 years, 10 years at the outside, very few people live with your disease more than 10 years, what would you do? And I told them, most people fear that they would fold up their tents and go home and wait to die, but very few humans do that, don't
mm-hmm.
they?
Mm-hmm. A great majority of people in situations like this, and you know, most of my practice is with people with cancer, and the psychological and emotional dimensions of this disease. Most people regard this as an invitation to the dance, shall we say. Most people find that they examine what is real for them, what has meaning, what matters, and live much closer to that in a way that is more courageous and even, if I might say, passionate than ever before. It's almost as if they don't have the time for anything that isn't true.
One of the great gifts in my life, and one of the most painful, was when I was truly confronted with the truth of my life and my future. I was 30, young 30s, mid-30s. And I was confronted with the choice to live or to die, that my life wasn't going to change, I wasn't going to walk, I wasn't going to be less ill, nothing was going to change about my body, and my only choices were to live with what I had and who I was, or to die.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt so blessed by having that stark black and white choice, because most people I know don't make any choice. They live as though their real lives are coming around the corner. Their real lives are coming, you know, when the kids leave or when they retire or when their spouse changes, you know. Their real lives are coming right around the corner. And I don't believe you've lived as though there is a corner for you. Certainly I have.
It's wonderful. But, you know, how can you put this? It's important to be able to live out loud. It takes courage to live according to who you genuinely are, not who other people want you to be, not who you think you're supposed to be, but who you genuinely are, to live out loud. And Dolly Parton, who, by the way, has said and written some very interesting things, said something like this, the important thing in life is to find out what matters and do it on purpose.
Mm. Mm.
And there is such a sense of purpose, a sharpening of purpose, an awareness of the gift and blessing of the simplest of things. A sunny day, a bush blooming in your garden. It's almost like you see in technicolor and appreciate the things that most people are too busy rushing around corners to see.
I don't know if I could have done that, to be honest, if life didn't hit me over the head with a 2x4 several times. So I needed a few whacks, and I'm going to need a couple more, I think, before the story's done.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I don't know, it's very hard to do without being forced to do
it. Well, there's a lot that mitigates against it in our culture.
Yeah.
You know, our culture is not a culture of awareness. It's not a culture that lives close to the kind of values that help you live well. There's so much that distracts us. But, you know, you spoke about my book, and I don't mean to embarrass you, Dan, but I'd like to speak a little bit about yours. You sent it to me, Letters to Sam, and it's wonderful.
Thank you.
And there's a chapter in it just about what we're talking about now. And it was right after your accident, I believe. You were immobilized in a halo vest. You couldn't even move your head. And you were sitting, lying there, you know, wondering if you could go on, if your life was worthwhile, if you were worthwhile. And this woman came to your bedside. You couldn't even see her. And asked you if you were a psychologist, and then began to tell you her pain and her troubles, even though you were lying there immobilized in this bed, and you were able to help her. And you found the will to live to go on. And I think this is one of the wisest stories I've read in a long time. Mm. And I think it's about Edwards, and about, you know, about saying that when we serve other people, when we live not just for ourselves, but for other people, we find the strength to deal with our own obstacles.
It's about Edwards. It's about being human. That's why I'm troubled when people call me strong or courageous or hero or any of those words, because
really?
I'm none of them, and I don't know that you are.
Nothing
personal. But, you know, it's just humans. We're doing what humans do. I mean, we might be blessed to be able to have a pulpit to talk about it or be eloquent enough to say it so people want to hear, but it's just being human.
What I was going to say is, you know, people like you and I have the privilege of pointing to courage, pointing to the things that are important. In other words, when someone says to me, "You're so courageous," they're making themselves small.
Mm-hmm.
All I am is what everybody is.
Right.
That under the challenge, people find in themselves a greatness that they have no idea that they had, and it's part of being a human being.
Right. Well, listen, I have selfishly hogged all of your time for the first half of the show, and all of our lines have been lit up and are lit up with people who also want to talk to you. So let's let some of the readers have a chance to listen to you and ask you questions. Let's start with Lucy on line 6.
Hello.
Hi, Lucy.
Hi, Dan. This is a wonderful conversation, and when you were speaking earlier about service, I was medicine and service, I was remembering something that I experienced at Christmas when I was home with my father, who had broken a hip in the summer, and his whole life changed. He's 89, he can't live on his own anymore. And when I saw him at Christmas, he was living with one of my brothers who did absolutely everything for him, and he was not settled. You know, he was really unhappy. And one of the things that was happening for him is that there was not a sense of spirituality in the house. Like, they're really good for him, but they just, in their own way of living, they don't really live out a faith life. And my dad is quite a strong Catholic, so that was real important. Anyways, I was taking Dad to the doctor, and I asked him if it would be all right when we went to the doctor if we could talk about depression. And so we did, and the doctor was so wonderful to Dad. Dad's had him for about 40 years, and he did exactly what you described. He took us up a chair, and he sat beside Dad, and he was just really attentive. And then when, you know, Dad was describing some of the loneliness that he felt in this kind of the isolation of the faith life and stuff, the doctor talked some more, and then he said, "And now let's pray." And I was really taken aback, because I'm a Catholic sister. I didn't even expect that. But it was so touching. And he prayed this very beautiful prayer. And then my dad said at the end, "Well, I hope that'll be better." And the doctor said, "Hope it will be better. It might not be what you want. Everything will work out, but it will work out because we've left it in God's hands."
Lucy, what?
And then the point of that was that it was the presence of this doctor that was so wonderful. And my dad said, he's my friend. And that's kind of what I heard you saying with the others, is a presence. You know, that was so, so important.
Yes.
And that's all I wanted to share. And that's a real gift, and it's a work to be present.
Lucy, yes. Thank you so much for your call. Rachel, I want to hear your reaction. You talk a great deal about prayer. Tell us what is it, and who do you pray to, and for what? Can you be an atheist or an agnostic and still pray?
But let me just respond to Lucy, Dan, because what she says is so wise, that it's all about presence. It's all about being together and being there and being completely at the service of another person. And this doctor prayed with her father. And that there's so much that we can offer people that doesn't come in a scientific package that enables people to live. Let me share one of my own experiences. I was very young, and you know, I've had 8 major surgeries on my intestine, and this surgery was to be a 10-hour affair that was going to remove a large part of what I was born with. And I remember being terrified by it, absolutely terrified. And as I was lying on the table in the operating room, my surgeon approached the table and said that they were about to put me under the anesthetic, and was there anything I wanted to say? And I tried to say the Shema, which is the prayer that Jewish people say when they are in terrible danger, which affirms the power of the source of the universe. Hear, O Israel, the Lord God, the Lord is one. And I said that in Hebrew, and he leaned over me and said, is that a prayer? And I said, yes. And he says, well, I always pray before every surgery, but I don't do it out loud. And I said, would you say it out loud, your prayer? And he said, yes. Dear God, help us to do here whatever is most right. And I could feel my fear just leave me. And I went into the anesthesia and came out into the recovery room, absolutely held. Not that I was going to get my way, but that what would happen here made sense in some larger context that I, as a human being, might not ever be able to understand. And that it isn't a random world and we're not in danger. This is an American Indian prayer, by the way. And if I hadn't been willing to say my little prayer out loud, he would never have told me. I asked him afterwards if he had ever told his patients that he prayed before the surgery, and he said no.
And your story, which was beautiful and touching, your story really addresses, I think, my last question about prayer. That you don't need a God in the religious sense to pray.
You don't need a religion to pray. But you need a sense that there is something behind the life we live. That there is something larger and mysterious that is happening in this world.
And that sounds like that prayer could be also, you know, you mentioned the doctor's prayer. It could also be a Buddhist prayer, too. It's not
truly
to a God, per se, but praying to the larger context to do the right thing. There's no ego in that prayer.
No. Help us to do what is most right.
Yeah. No.
And you see, here's the thing. You asked me about the healer's art, this course. Based on a number of premises, one is that there is a lineage of medicine, a wisdom, which is passed between students and their teachers, which forms the integrity of medicine. And that, as such, medicine is not a job. It's a way of life.
Right.
And it's a spiritual way of life. It's a way of life that is characterized by service, compassion, reverence for life, deep caring, all of the qualities of the Hippocratic Oath, which are spiritual qualities, harmlessness, one of the highest of the spiritual qualities, especially in Buddhism, harmlessness, wisdom, altruism.
Well, I just want to make my observation of the Hippocratic Oath, which I think fits with your values, and then we're going to take a break. But, you know, Hippocrates said, this is not relative to the oath, but Hippocrates said that inside of every patient there is a doctor, a healing potential. And my plea, when I talk to doctors and therapists, I say that inside of every doctor there's a patient.
Yes.
And unless all four come to the encounter, there's a lie in the room, and healing can't be possible when there's a lie in the room.
Well, Jung refers to that as the wounded healer.
Right, right.
The archetype.
Right.
And so, it is our vulnerability that turns out to be our strength.
So let's take a short break. We'll come back and chat with more callers, and I want to also talk about your visit here to Philadelphia. We're talking with Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen today, world-renowned author, doctor, lecturer, teacher, and a person with Crohn's disease. She's written best-selling Kitchen Table Wisdom and My Grandfather's Blessings. And if you would like to chat with her, her number is 888-477-9499. If you've had an experience of healing with a doctor or missed one, give us a call. If you're a doctor, love to hear your story of what doctoring means to you. Again, that's 888-477-9499, 888-477-WHYY. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
The Depression Research Unit of the University of Pennsylvania Medical Center supports WHYY. Penn's DRU is conducting research into alternative herbal treatments of anxiety. Symptoms may include nervousness, tension, sleep problems, and concentration difficulty. Those who qualify will receive an initial evaluation and may take part in a research study with chamomile or black cohosh for up to 3 months. For details, 215-662-3462.
Next time on Day to Day.
This is a collect call from Robert.
Robert Daniels' only contact with the outside world is through a payphone.
He's in jail, not for a crime, though, but for having a rare form of tuberculosis.
They don't have the right to isolate me from, especially my family, everything. I mean, I'm all alone here.
How did he wind up behind bars?
And how can he get out?
I never thought that this could happen.
The story
next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're with Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen, well-known author, doctor, healer, poet, as a matter of fact. One of your many poems, I don't even know if it was a poem, something you said, but it was an experience you had when you were 15 years old. You got your diagnosis of Crohn's disease. I believe it was in Manhattan, right?
Yes.
And you said that you walked out of the doctor's office and you saw growing through the cracks in the sidewalk grass.
Yes.
Growing. And you thought,
yes,
if grass can be so resilient and have such a powerful life force to grow through this kind of hostile environment, then you can live with Crohn's disease.
Well, you know, Dan, it wasn't growing through a crack in the sidewalk. These two tender green blades of grass were growing right through the cement. Right through the cement. And it struck me as a total mystery. They were green and tender. They weren't violent. They weren't confrontative. They were just unstoppable.
Well, You know why that happened. In the Talmud, it says every blade of grass has an angel standing over it, saying, grow, grow. Yeah.
I remember that. And so does every human being.
Perfect.
There's
yeah.
something in us that yearns towards our own dream of ourselves.
Which
and
is?
That something is what medicine has to collaborate.
And it is precisely that also. And I want to talk about this later in the show. It is just that life force that often makes death such a problem for us. Let's go to the phones. We've got Joe Price on the line.
Hi. Hello?
Yes.
Hi, Dan.
Hi there.
Dan, we've crossed paths many times over these last 15, 20 years. Mm-hmm. I'm really enjoying what I'm hearing this morning, this afternoon, I guess, now for the 19th time. I practice holistic medicine in Mount Airy.
Yes.
Been doing it for the last 30-some years, and I have felt such resonance to the discussion this morning. I've been both a doctor and a patient, and as a doctor, I have felt that often the clearest way to healing is by trying to walk in the patient's shoes, and I was resonating to the prayer that your speaker had spoken about. And I have also prayed with patients from time to time when I feel that they've just been at their wit's end as to what to do next.
Hmm. Yeah, it's a wonderful gift. Rachel, you talk about meaning a great deal, and what illness means to the patient as being so important, but what medicine means to the doctor changes from doctor to doctor, doesn't it? I mean, we're listening to Joe now describe what being a doctor means to him, but
exactly.
Joe's story's not the same for every doctor.
Well, you know, in the healer's art, this course, which is a 15-hour course for first and second-year medical students, at the very end, we talk about calling. We talk about the deep meaning of the work, and that the work for many people is a calling. And that there is a commitment to this work, which can only be expressed in the form of a poetry. The Hippocratic Oath is a poetry, or prayer. The Oath of Maimonides is actually a prayer. And we help these students to write their own Hippocratic Oath, each one. And then they read them out loud, along with their faculty, who also write. And you can't tell who's a faculty and who's a student, because we've gone beyond the divisiveness of our expertise, and we're occupying the common ground of our commitment and intention to serve other people. And let me just say one of these things out loud to you. It's written by a football player, an ex-football player, big hunk of a fellow, who wants to be a surgeon. And he wrote this in class and read it out loud. He says he's dedicating it to his future patients. And it's about what Lucy was talking about, too, about presence and how presence heals. And it goes like this. May you find in me the mother of the world. May my hands be a mother's hands. My heart be a mother's heart. May my response to your suffering be a mother's response to your suffering. Hmm. May I sit with you in the dark as a mother sits in the dark. May you know through our relationship that there is something in this world that can be trusted. And you know, these kinds of statements, I have thousands of them. There are thousands and thousands of students across the country and even around the world who have taken this course. And these kinds of statements are buried underneath the scientific expertise, the years of study, and it's very important for doctors to raise them up again and speak them out loud.
Yeah, I would imagine the longer the doctor is in practice, the more excavation might be required, but it's in there, huh?
It's always in there, and yeah. It doesn't take much. It takes a safe space and a listening ear.
Joe, thanks so much for your call and your comments. And if you like what Rachel has to say, I'd like you to know, I'm going to give you more details later. She's going to be in town on April 20th. She's giving a talk for the Jefferson Myrna Brin Center for Integrative Medicine. And you can get more information on their website at jeffersonhospital.org. Well, let's go back to the callers. We've got Mary Ann on the line. Marianne?
Hi.
Hi.
I'm so excited. I've never spoken. I've listened to your show constantly, and your guest is one of my... She absolutely can never know how much she impacted my life. I went through an absolutely life-altering situation 6.5 years ago, and my grandfather's blessing, specifically the story about the seedling, and now I base everything in my life upon attention, attention, attention.
Well, wait a minute. One of you is going to have to give us a summary of the story on the seedling.
Oh, please, you do it. It's the most wonderful story. It really...
Is this the story about the little cup?
The little cup with the seedling that your grandfather gave you with the water. Yes.
My grandfather wanted to teach me about service, about befriending life. And he never taught anything. He always set you up to learn it. You know, and then when you learned it, you'd run to him and say, "Grandpa, guess what I found out?" And he would say, "How wonderful, Shumala." And, of course, he had set you up to find out that very thing. And so once he brought me a little cup as a present, a little paper cup, and in it was dirt. And I was disappointed because I thought there was going to be something special in it. Here it was full of dirt, and I told him I couldn't play with dirt. I wasn't allowed to. And he said, "Well, let me show you what you do." And he took me into the kitchen and showed me how to put a little water into the cup. And he said, "If you do this every day, something may happen." And it made absolutely no sense to me. I was living on the 6th floor of a tenement in New York City. I had no idea what happened when you put water on dirt. But I loved him, and so I told him I would do it. And the first week was exciting. Something was going to happen. Nothing did. Second week got hard. And when I saw him again, I tried to give the cup back to him, but he wouldn't take it. He kept saying every day. And the third week was very hard. But I didn't miss a single day. And then one morning, there were 2 little green leaves in the cup that hadn't been there the night before. And I was astounded. I was sure he would be just as surprised as I was. But he wasn't, Dan. And what he said was, "Anushumala, life is everywhere, hidden in the most unexpected and ordinary of places." And I was thrilled, and I said, "And all it needs is water, Grandpa." And he said to me, "No, no, no, darling. All life needs is your faithfulness."
What a beautiful story. I had forgotten that. Marianne, thank you so much for calling in and reminding us of that wonderful story.
We need to tend the life in ourselves, you know, Dan.
Yeah, and that's not being done very much.
We're not encouraged to do it. It's seen as selfish.
Yeah. And so many of us don't seem to have time to do it. We're so busy working for some kind of a mythical future.
Mm-hmm. The future is right this minute. We're going to have to. We're going to have to stop talking soon, are we?
Yeah.
Oh dear.
However, those listening could come to Jefferson and listen to you talk on the 20th. Your lecture is about becoming a blessing.
Yes, it's about the power of ordinary people to change other people's lives, to make a difference in this world.
I've got a question of you, something I'm sure you've thought about, and I mentioned it in today's article. I was facing surgery a couple of years ago, and it was not terribly likely I was going to come out of this surgery alive. I had a high fever, I had an infection that was going into my spine, and I laid there in my room by myself. It was late at night, it was emergency surgery, so it was evening surgery. I laid in my room by myself, and I thought, if I survive this surgery, would I want to do anything different with my life? And my answer was no, I didn't. You've been in that position. What would your answer be?
My answer would be no. That the disease that I've lived with has given me the courage to live with a great integrity. There are things I haven't done in my life. But there's so many things that I have done that I would never have been able to do without the impetus of this illness in my life.
What do you mean?
I mean, I wouldn't have taken the risk. Like, I'm talking to you on the radio. I'm a shy person. I'm not the sort of person who talks on the radio or writes books, even. I'm very personal. I don't, you know, I'm a private person. I wouldn't know that I could make a difference to strangers. I wouldn't know that everybody needs love. I wouldn't know anything like that without this illness.
Yeah, you know, the Buddhists talk about this. My dear friend and colleague, Polly Young Eisendrath, wrote a book years ago called The Gifts of Suffering. And,
yeah.
You know, at the risk of sounding pedantic and like a Hallmark card, it does carry a gift. Underneath it, it does carry a gift. And if we're lucky, it carries the gift of wisdom.
Yes.
Well, I have bad news for many people at the moment, that we're out of time. That's bad news for me. I guess it's bad news for you. I know it's bad news for all our listeners. Thank you so much for coming again on the show, and I look forward to seeing you in a couple weeks here in Philly.
Oh, wonderful, Dan. Me too.
Yeah. We will meet, we will hug. I've been wanting to do that for a long time.
Oh, lovely. I look forward.
Please take care.
You too.
Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen is co-founder and medical director of the Commonweal Cancer Help Program. She's the author of the New York Times bestsellers Kitchen Table Wisdom and My Grandfather's Blessings. Rachel will be here in April lecturing and speaking to medical students at the Myrna Brin Center for Integrative Medicine. On April 20th, she presents Becoming a Blessing, Living Your Life as Though It Makes a Difference. It's at 8 p.m. at the Hyatt Regency. That lecture is open to the public. It's at www.jeffersonhospital.org. This Wednesday, I'm giving a lecture on the pursuit of happiness and meaning in everyday life. It's sponsored by the Mount Laurel Municipal Alliance Against Substance Abuse. For more information, look at my website, drdangottlieb.com. And on Monday, April 9th at 6 o'clock, right here on WHYY, in live, we're having a special on In the Spirit of Family, Siblings, Adult Children, and Adult Relationships. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Christine Dempsey's our executive producer. Elisa Walters our associate producer. Mike and Scott produces Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Have a great year, Phillies. See you next week.
Day to day.